from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Google the words gluten-free and you find stories about a gluten-free Christmas or gluten-free mac and cheese. And perhaps most intriguingly, should we all go gluten-free? Well, should we? In the hour ahead, we'll examine the gluten-free phenomenon. Does a gluten-free diet really make sense? And if so, for whom? We'll explore why the gluten-free diet has attracted so many adherents and what the science says about it. Going gluten-free. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When you hear the words gluten-free, what do you think? Do you just roll your eyes and write it off as the latest fad? Or do you consider it a healthy trend that for many is also a medical necessity? Gluten is a protein found in grains like wheat, barley, and rye. And for the growing number of Americans diagnosed with celiac disease, gluten-free food is a must in order to avoid serious gastrointestinal problems. But choosing to go gluten-free, even if you don't need to, is also becoming increasingly popular. Indeed, Americans will spend $4.2 billion on gluten-free products this year. In this hour forum, we want to explore what's behind the rising popularity of gluten-free diets, when it's necessary, when it's not, and when it's in between, and what the risks are, if any, of going gluten-free. Joining us to have that conversation today, Dr. Nielsen Fernandez-Becker. She's the Associate Director of Celiac Management Clinic at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Fernandez-Becker, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Joining us as well is Jefferson Adams. He is gluten intolerant himself and a writer for celiac.com. His brother Scott also has celiac disease. Jefferson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And joining us from Boston this morning, Melinda Dennis. She's a dietitian and nutrition coordinator at the Celiac Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. She also has celiac disease and is the co-author of Real Life with Celiac Disease, Troubleshooting and Thriving Gluten-Free. Melinda Dennis, thanks for joining us.
Hello, good morning.
So let's begin with some definitions, because there's a lot of things on the table here when it comes to talking about this particular condition. Dr. Fernandez-Becker, define celiac disease first, and then we'll go to the sort of variations along the continuum.
Sure. So celiac disease is a complex autoimmune and inflammatory disease of the small intestine that's triggered by the protein gluten, which is found in wheat, rye, and barley. And basically, repeated ingestion of gluten causes injury to the small intestine. And to understand this process, you'd have to go back to early in development when we are being exposed to new substances. And our immune system has to learn to distinguish between a potentially harmful substance versus something that's harmless or it's even beneficial to you. And this is important because if you have an infection with a bacteria, you want your immune cells to react in such a way that it would eradicate the threat. However, if it's something innocuous or a nutrient that you need, you want the immune system to dampen its response. And this is a process called tolerance. And what we think happens in celiac disease is that there's a breakdown of this process. And an otherwise harmless, innocuous protein is now recognized as a potential pathogen.
So your system is misreading things. Is that right?
Exactly.
And does that mean then that this is somewhere along the line things weren't introduced? You said it's something we learn in development. I think of like babies are gradually introduced to different kinds of food. What's the origins then of the fact that in people with celiac disease that they're not able to read things correctly, that they misread what that protein is?
It's interesting. It seems like many other complex disorders. It seems to be multifactorial, and it's associated, there's a genetic component to it. There's also the environmental component, and also immunity plays a role. And the genetic component is actually quite striking. More than 99% of the cases of celiac disease carry the genes for HLA-DQ2 or DQ8. However, the flip side is that just having these genes doesn't give you celiac disease. There's about 35% of the population that have them, and only about 2 to 3% will develop celiac disease. So there's probably another trigger. And we don't know exactly what that is.
We'll explore that over the course of the hour, what else may be going on and why it is that there seems to be a greater prevalence of celiac disease. But let's also talk some about what living with this condition is like. Jefferson Adams, first, because in your family, this is some of what would apply to what Dr. Fernandez-Becker was just saying. Mom has celiac disease, your brother, and you are somewhere else on the continuum. But describe what that is like for your brother, for your mom, for people who struggle with this condition.
Sure. To go back to what Dr. Becker was saying, I'm one of those people who has the positive genetic markers, but does not have if you do a biopsy, I don't have the intestinal damage that makes a diagnosis for celiac disease right now. So from my family, my brother does have celiac disease. And for him, it's funny, the more when you go on a diet and avoid gluten, you then become more sensitive to it. So that later on, for some people, so that later on when you ingest it, your sensitivity is really high. So in his case, he has pretty striking symptoms. He gets pretty, stomach symptoms, upset stomach, almost what you'd call like a stomach flu-like symptoms for a couple of days when he ingests it. For me, it's more of a cumulative thing over a few days. But it's for my mom, same thing. She has an immediate reaction and notices right away that she's ingested wheat and gluten.
And Melinda Dennis, for someone like you who also suffers from celiac disease, describe what that's like, what that has been like for you.
So I was diagnosed 22 years ago, and it was discovered because I was diagnosed with the dermatitis herpetiformis, which is a topical manifestation of celiac disease, an itchy, blistering skin rash that appears on extensor surfaces like knees and elbows. So that was a very odd way to be diagnosed over two decades ago. But I definitely have celiac disease. And for me, it's been a continual learning process watching the unfolding and the blossoming of this gluten-free market over all this time and increased awareness as well as what's being done in research and in medicine to understand it better and treat our patients better.
And what does it mean for you in terms of just your daily life, what you can eat and what you can't?
So I no longer consider it a problem as I did in the beginning when I wasn't sure what to eat. Again, two decades ago, it was a little bit hard to determine what was gluten-free and what wasn't. There were a lot of misconceptions out there. But for me, it's been an opportunity to explore even more foods, more interesting foods, other cuisines. Always in the back of my mind, the issue of cross-contamination and how I'm going to be prepared for whatever I'm doing or wherever I'm going is paramount, because preparation is our middle name when you have to be concerned all the time about cross-contamination.
But in terms of things that you avoid, just so that we understand the basics of this disease, even though I hear you saying that you've found your way around it and there are opportunities within that new cuisine or new lifestyle, what are the things that you just do not eat?
So the basic list is wheat, rye, barley, malt, brewer's yeast, and oats, unless they're specially produced and labeled gluten-free. And then beyond that, any derivative of that. So it would include, any breads, cakes, cookies, crackers, rolls, buns, candy that are made with any of the grains I mentioned. And then more of the hidden glutens, if you'd like to talk about that. Soy sauce that is brewed with wheat, or communion wafers that contain wheat, some of the things that people don't necessarily think about.
So let's talk about who these rules apply to, Dr. Fernandez-Becker, and whether or not anybody who has celiac disease has to follow the regimen that we heard Melinda Dennis just describe, as opposed to someone like Jefferson who doesn't have the disease but has a certain level of intolerance. Are the rules the same regardless of whether or not you officially have the disease versus just being gluten intolerant?
I think the rules are slightly different. And when a patient comes to see me who has wheat intolerance or gluten intolerance, then the first order of business is trying to figure out whether they have celiac disease. And in that we do by a variety of blood tests and also an endoscopy. But there's also the possibility of wheat allergy. And if the patient does have celiac disease, they, you know, gluten is a toxic substance to them, and they definitely have to be strict about it, about adhering to a gluten-free diet. However, with gluten sensitivity, that's non-celiac variety, and again, I totally agree that we have to learn more about this disease entity. It may be part of the spectrum of celiac disease. I find that in some patients, they'll tolerate some forms of wheat, but not others. And some patients are extremely sensitive, who the minute they ingest gluten, they develop symptoms.
Where are you for that, Jefferson, as someone who's intolerant but doesn't have the disease? Are you okay with a beer but not a baked good? Or how do you make that distinction?
Generally really sensitive to beer. Some – for me, it's more of a cumulative thing. I'll notice it over a day or two. A couple of days where I start to get an upset stomach and not feel very good and my energy is really low. And it may be, as we said, that if this is part of a spectrum of celiac disease, that you don't have the intestinal damage yet, but if you continued to eat wheat over time, you would maybe develop it. We just don't know that quite yet. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it is generally a couple of days. I could theoretically eat gluten here and there. I try not to and really try hard to avoid it.
So you can develop it? It would seem to me that if it's largely hereditary, you're either in or you're out. Not the case, Dr. Fernandez?
Not the case. You could develop celiac disease pretty much at any time, in infancy and in adulthood. And what we know is that there's a clear genetic predisposition, as I said earlier. So if you have these genes, then you are at risk for developing the disease. What we don't know is what the
triggers?
Inciting event is, and it's a subject of intense research right now. Anecdotally, we see patients that after they've had a very severe viral gastroenteritis or bacterial infection or even pregnancy, they later go on to develop celiac disease.
It sounds like a variation on that old adage with lots of diseases that genetics loads the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. So something trips you over to the other side. Let's widen our discussion some and talk about the increasing popularity of this diet, Melinda Dennis, for those who aren't either have celiac disease or who may not all even be gluten intolerant. It seems like something that you bump into all the time these days. And I confess to being one of those I mentioned at the top of the program, are you somebody who rolls their eyes? I confess I'm someone who sometimes rolls my eyes when I hear someone saying that I hear gluten-free. It seems like every time I turn around. So what do you make of that? And is there wisdom in that going gluten-free is a choice that more people ought to make, regardless of whether or not they have a degree of intolerance?
Well, it's interesting that Dr. Alessio Fasano, formerly of the University of Maryland Celiac Center, does believe that everybody in the United States is eating a little bit more wheat than they actually need to. So because of how we've modified the wheat protein to contain so much more gluten than ever in previous years. So that in itself is interesting. But I think what's out there most prominently is the idea that perhaps you can lose weight on the gluten-free diet. It's not necessarily true. If you look at a label of a gluten-containing product, compare it to a gluten-free one, you're going to see much higher amounts of carbohydrates, usually less fiber, more salt, sugar, more fat to make up for the mouth texture and feel that you're missing. And therein lies one of the main issues, particularly if you've just moved on to the gluten-free diet and you're feeling a little bit deprived and are looking for immediate substitutions in the commercial food industry.
So what do you advise as a nutritionist and dietitian with people who come in and you know, want your consult on this but aren't necessarily gluten intolerant or have celiac disease? Do you think it's a good idea for people to pursue that sort of diet?
If you do not have celiac disease and you don't have a wheat allergy, as Dr. Becker was mentioning, and you don't sense that gluten is giving you any symptoms, as was also described, any of the gastrointestinal issues, no headaches or migraines, no word droppings or concentration, things like that, then there's very little reason to pursue the gluten-free diet because if it's not done well, you're actually at risk for some of the nutritional deficiencies that can arise. The gluten-free diet can be low in calcium and vitamin D and magnesium, fiber, and iron if it's not done really well in a balanced way. So that is the first thing I talk about.
And do you concur with that, Dr. Fernandez-Becker, that you should only adopt this if you need to? It shouldn't become a food fad?
I agree with that, yes. And one of my major concerns is, as Melinda mentioned, that patients will place themselves in a very strict diet, and it's so restrictive that they don't get the nutrients they need. And that's fairly common. And
so what are the dangers? What are the – or not the dangers, but what are the problems of a gluten-free diet that you have to be mindful of?
Well, if you're a celiac patient, one of the dangers is that there's a lot of hidden sources of gluten, and you have to be aware of it. But the dangers of being on a gluten-free diet and not requiring it are more nutritional deficiencies.
Vitamins.
Vitamins, calcium, vitamins and minerals in particular.
What kind of – on your website, Jefferson, what are the most common concerns that people write in about, that you write about as far as dealing with some of these sorts of problems, the vitamin issue and others?
Sure. Well, at celiac.com we run both the website, we run an online forum which allows – we have moderators and field individual questions. We also run a Journal of Gluten Sensitivity, so which is a publication. So they're multifarious. There are people writing in with questions about diet, general diet questions, some of the types of stuff you're asking right now. Product questions, you know, do you know where I can get a gluten-free type of product here? Is, you know, for example, is soy sauce, you know, gluten-free? You might get a question like that, and the moderators will come in and try and ask. I myself generally write about the latest medical research into celiac disease. I do some writing also about recipes and general interest stuff. It may be, you know, celebrities, fad diet, stuff like that.
What about this problem of several of you have referenced this cross-contamination issue, which I assume means that you have to be careful about a food product that, even though it doesn't contain a grain, came from a manufacturer where grains are present. Is that a real concern? Is the degree of sensitivity such that just if there's flour in the air somewhere, that's problematic?
Yes, in celiac disease, there's been studies that have shown that all you need is about 50 milligrams of gluten per day to propagate the inflammation.
And that's a tiny amount, 50
That's
milligrams.
A small amount. And to put into perspective for my patients, I tell them that a slice of standard white bread is about 4 grams, which is 4,000 milligrams. So it matters. And I ask my patients to be mindful of that. So I try to get them not to handle flour because they may inadvertently ingest some. And also it's a good idea to keep the condiments separate from somebody else's that consumes gluten and to make sure to label their own foods very clearly.
Dr. Nielsen Fernandez-Becker joins us. She's the Associate Director of the Celiac Management Clinic at Stanford School of Medicine. With us as well, Melinda Dennis, Dietitian and Nutrition Coordinator for the Celiac Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and Jefferson Adams, who writes for the website celiac.com. We're going to open up our phone lines early and take your questions about going gluten-free and the kinds of issues that you contend with if you are someone who is dealing with celiac disease or has decided to make the switch to going to a gluten-free diet. You can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website or Facebook page and add your comments there. Here's some comments already coming in. Margaret writes on our website, I was diagnosed with celiac 3 years ago, as well as osteoporosis due to celiac. My bone scans are better now, but I don't hear about this connection much in the media. I'm happy that there are many gluten-free options on the market, however. So what's the connection there? If you're on a gluten-free diet, does that have an impact in terms of bone density?
Well, so basically, when you have celiac disease, the intestine is injured or diseased, and as a result, you don't absorb certain vitamins, particularly fat-soluble vitamins, and vitamin D is one of them. So it's not uncommon for patients with active celiac disease to have very low levels of vitamin D, and this adversely affects bone health. So one of the things that we recommend is after the patient has been on a stable gluten-free diet for at least 6 months to a year is to have a baseline bone mineral density. And the hope is that as you are on a gluten-free diet, then the mucosa heals, your ability to absorb these nutrients are better, and hence the bone health will improve.
Melinda Dennis, has that been an issue for you or others that you consult with or counsel?
I'm so sorry, Dave. I had to patch out because of a telephone problem. Can I have the question again?
Sure. We just had an emailed question from someone saying that they were dealing with the dual problem of celiac disease and osteoporosis. And Dr. Fernandez-Becker was working us through why there is that problem sometimes because of the inability to process that in the intestine, calcium. So has that been an issue for you? And is that an additional concern that you have to deal with your patients and clients?
Oh, absolutely. Osteoporosis is one of the leading concerns with celiac disease. And so what we do in clinic is we work towards a lactose, if they're lactose intolerant, which is one of the reasons they could be having the osteoporosis, in addition to the malabsorption that I'm sure she described, we'll work on a lactose-reduced diet for a period of about 3 months so that they're able to tolerate lactose products slowly. We will work very hard on calcium and vitamin D supplementation to bring their vitamin D levels back up to normal and work on vitamin K sources through food and always mention the importance of weightlifting and resistance exercises to help also with bone health. But it's absolutely something we see in clinic all the time, usually paired with a problem with lactose intolerance.
Here's a website question from Liz Jordan. Maybe you can take a swing at. Liz writes, I was diagnosed with celiac disease 5 years ago. Two issues I face are that some brands, such as Trader Joe's, label food gluten-free that have been processed on equipment shared with wheat. This is the cross-contamination question we've talked about some. The food is therefore not safe for celiacs. Also, many restaurant servers are fed up with the gluten-free trend and are often impatient and don't take seriously my concerns. So what do you write about and advise for people in dealing with either of those problems, whether they can trust the label and what to do in restaurants?
Sure.
Hang on 1 second, Melinda. I just wanted to get Jefferson's comments first, and then we'll come back to you.
The first part about the cross-contamination in factories and whatnot. There's recently been some studies showing that could you tell me the second part of your question again?
Sure. The second part is how to deal with restaurant and servers who don't take you seriously.
Yeah. So this is a serious concern on both the forum and in general for people on a gluten-free diet, for people with celiac disease especially, is that there needs to be a very dedicated, focused preparation of foods that are being sold to the public.
And we'll pick up on that thought and more when we come back. We'll get answers to that question. What do you tell restaurant servers? And how do you go about believing and reading labels? What sort of scrutiny do food labels really deserve? We'll take that up when we return. We welcome your questions as well at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic in this second hour Forum today, going gluten-free. What are the issues for people who must be on gluten-free diets? What are some of the risks that are involved in that diet? And should you go on it if you don't have a specific medical need? Joining us to provide answers to those questions, Dr. Nielsen Fernandez-Becker from Stanford University School of Medicine, Melinda Dennis, a dietitian and nutrition at the Celiac Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Jefferson Adams is here as well. He writes for the website celiac.com. We're going to take more of your calls and get some other opinions added into our program in just a sec. But before the break, Jefferson, you were going to provide a couple of suggestions. If you're going out to dinner and you need to deal with this question, how do you ask the question, I guess, in the right way so that you get the answers you need from the restaurant and from your server?
Sure, sure. This is, as I said, a really important issue. It keeps, it's one that keeps a lot of people with celiac disease, especially if they're very sensitive, from eating out. So I think one of the things that you need to do is really be, you know, vigilant about asking your server and your food restaurant manager, how are foods prepared, making clear that it's very important that you, you know, avoid.
Sort of the same way someone with like a serious peanut allergy or something like that would approach it. This is not a fad. This is something that for me is a crucial health question.
Yeah. If you let them know, like, look, I get ill if I have food prepared with wheat or flour. Make sure that the food is prepared in a certain type of way.
And Melinda Dennis, what would you add to that? And also the other part of our last question about sort of deciphering labels on food products so that you can really count on the fact that when someone says it's gluten-free, it's gluten-free.
Well, fortunately, very soon the FDA should be finalizing its definition of gluten-free as under 20 parts per million gluten. And once that passes, if a product has the words gluten-free on it, the manufacturer has to be able to guarantee that there's under 20 parts per million cross-contamination.
And that's a really tiny amount then. So that's setting the bar at a pretty high level?
If you picture 1 million blue jelly beans, and you take 20 of those out and put blue ones or red ones in instead, that's the amount of contamination we're talking about. You're right. It's really, really small. Did I say 20 million? I hope I said 1 million.
No, I get the picture. So, and so that, but in the meantime, what do you have advice for how to go shopping?
Yes. If you're choosing a grain or flour-based product, make sure that it says gluten-free on the label. And avoid grain and flour-based products that look okay, appear to be gluten-free, but do contain that voluntary allergen statement. That's one of the safest ways to navigate through the grocery store for gluten-free products. There's also the certification companies out there that are certifying gluten-free products to under 10 or 5 parts per million. So it's an added assurance, just another safety tip for those who are shopping.
Let's take some of our other calls and questions coming in. Here's a first caller from Davis. Jack joins us first. Jack, go ahead.
I have a question for the doctor, and then I'd like to have a follow-up after she answers it. I continue to be anemic, even though I've been a long-time gluten-free person, and I was just wondering what you might suggest as a cause of that.
Well, I don't know your case specifically. Do you have celiac disease?
Well, I've never been officially diagnosed, but if I told you my family history and my personal history, you would say, yes, I have celiac disease.
Okay.
I've been gluten-free now for over 30 years.
Okay. Well, in order, in celiac disease in general, if you have active disease, then because of the injury to the lining of the small intestine, you can definitely develop anemia. It's a very common symptom of celiac disease. And
that would be true even if you were on a gluten-free diet, that problem would still take place?
Well, most of the time when you go on a gluten-free diet, the injury reverses. And over the course of months to possibly up to a year, the lining of the intestine heals enough, and most studies show that the anemia resolves. However, there are situations where the gluten-free diet in a known celiac fails to work. And this is when we get into the realm of refractory celiac disease. So all of a sudden, the therapy is not effective. And there are two varieties of refractory celiac. Thankfully, this is a rare condition. The type 1 variety, sometimes we use immunosuppressants to get things under control. But generally, people do well. The second type, refractory type 2, is more ominous and has a more guarded prognosis and is associated with malignancies and such. So my suggestion would be, you know, to see your doctor and try to evaluate for the intestine to see if there's any injury.
And Jack, you wanted a brief follow-up, if you would. Jack, are you with us still?
Still here.
Yeah, go ahead with your quick follow-up, please.
Yes, when I was 8 years old, I had appendicitis, and found out, you know, afterwards that my father's side of the family had this disease. I was just wondering if the doctor thought that might have been a reason for that early appendectomy attack.
Jack, thanks.
It's unclear. Early appendectomy seems to be related to some other diseases of the intestines, such as inflammatory bowel disease. I haven't seen this association in celiac disease, but that brings another point that there are other conditions that could mimic celiac disease that could give you intestinal injury, such as inflammatory bowel disease.
Jack, thanks for the call. It raises, though, lots of interesting questions about whether or not, and perhaps you can add some thoughts on this, Melinda, about this is a condition where it used not to be diagnosed as well or as often. The thought is that most people with celiac disease go undiagnosed. This takes a bit of assertiveness, right? I mean, this is something where you've got to be persistent and make sure, as Dr. Fernandez-Becker was saying, that you go in and get the advice you need.
Yes, you need to go in there. You need to be eating gluten when you go in there and ask for the tests. If you're suspicious of celiac disease, ask for the tests for the total IgA and the IgA-TTG. Those are two celiac antibody tests that any physician will recognize. And if those are elevated, have a follow-up conversation on the small bowel biopsy to definitively diagnose or rule it out.
And are doctors, in your experience, Melinda, are doctors taking this more seriously now? Is this something that people don't, as I was saying before, just roll their eyes at?
They are taking it more seriously. I mean, it's a well-known autoimmune disease. It's just that it's been grossly underdiagnosed in our country. But ever since the TTG became available as a very accessible and inexpensive blood test, diagnoses have been on the rise, thankfully.
Lots of questions that we should try to get to. Let's get through as many callers as we can here. Chase in Berkeley is next. Chase, go ahead.
Hi, my first question is about the unknown repercussions of just choosing to go gluten-free, like per se a pregnant woman could pass on a gluten intolerance to her child even though she herself is not gluten intolerant. If you could make yourself gluten intolerant by choosing to go gluten-free.
Oh, interesting. Okay, Chase, Dr. Fernandez-Becker. Hang on, Chase, just a sec. Let's get an answer to your question. So can you, by adopting this lifestyle, pass that trait on so that your child would be gluten intolerant because you've chosen that route?
Well, so the question is, avoidance of gluten, would it prevent the development of the disease?
Well, or would it encourage it? Because if you no longer have that in your system, would your child likely not be able to recognize that?
Well, the bottom line is we really don't know. However, like I said before, in terms of celiac disease and it's a little less defined in the non-celiac gluten sensitivity. But in celiac disease, if you recall, it is a combination of it's multifactorial. So it's going to be the genetics, which you're not going to be able to change with the ingestion of gluten, but also how our immune system responds to our environment, which in this case is gluten. So theoretically, there may be an interaction at that level, but that's going to be very hard to prove.
Chase, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to let you go. We've got lots of calls, and I want to get to more of our listener calls. Let's go to Julie next in San Francisco. Julie, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a nutritionist, and I specialize in children with autism, and I just wanted to share with the listeners and the guests that I have seen amazing improvements on a gluten-free diet for these kids. Even the AAP has acknowledged some of them have gut issues and opiates in their urine and things like that. So language improvements and hyperactivity and attentiveness, so I love what you're all doing, and I just wanted to share that for anybody else who might have children that are struggling, even not only with gut issues, but also with attention and behavior and learning.
Julie, thanks. Dr. Fernandez-Becker, can you concur or disagree with that assessment?
Well, you know, I often see patients who have who come with questions about this, and really the literature out there is mixed. And I think we need more studies to find the role, but I'm encouraged to hear this comment.
Jefferson, you want to add?
Well, her question brings to mind a recent article I summarized. The article appeared in the New York Times, and it was discussing autism as an inflammatory disease potentially that seems to have roots in the mothers while they're pregnant having an inflammatory response either from a bacterial or a viral infection.
It's tricky territory, though, I suspect, Melinda Dennis, in that with autism in particular, there often are these concerns and people, for very understandable reasons, want to find an answer. And now some of those potential possibilities have really been discounted. For example, the problem with or potential problem that people thought might incur with immunizations now thought not to be so. So is this something we have to be careful about, or is there solid evidence about the role this can play in autism?
Not solid evidence, but it's certainly, like Dr. Becker was saying, very encouraging. And I always work with, now again, I only see adult patients, but anyone who feels that they need to or must and avoid a food group because of sensitivities or celiac disease or an allergy, just work very hard to find the substitution to fill that in, especially in children. If you're going to take gluten out or dairy out, you need to just make sure they're getting all the nutrients to make up for that. And that's what you need to be careful of for the balance, the overall balance.
Julie, thanks for bringing that to us. Really interesting possibility. We should add, by the way, that we have links to the resources that we're mentioning during our show today, as well as links to gluten-free recipes from KQED's food blog, Bay Area Bites. They're all on our website, kqed.org/forum. We're going to hear from another individual who has an interesting perspective on this as well. Sadie Sheffer joins us. She's the owner and founder of Bread Seriously. The website is breadsrsly.com, which delivers gluten-free bread around the city of San Francisco. Sadie, thanks for joining us. Tell us briefly what you're doing and the kind of reception that it's getting.
Yeah, I am a baker of gluten-free and vegan sourdough bread. It's had an amazing reception over the last year in San Francisco and in Berkeley. And I try to push the benefits of sourdough and long fermentation breads, as they're traditionally made with gluten. Now I make them gluten-free.
And do you deliver these to restaurants and kitchens and individual customers, all of the above?
I deliver to individuals and to grocery stores right now, not in any restaurants quite yet.
Okay, stay with us if you would, Sadie. We'll see if we get some other questions about how you bake and how you deal with all of this, and hopefully you can take some of those questions and respond to some of our recipe requests that are stacking up in my handful of emails in front of me. Jefferson, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I'm really happy to hear that Sadie's featuring sourdough, because there is some study to support this idea that sourdough fermentation can really help heal gut damage in people with celiac disease.
Let's go to Laura next in Alameda. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. You know, it's really interesting. I have a comment. I had been, as a girl, diagnosed. I was stomach issues. I was diagnosed lactose intolerant. That was primarily, I believe, because people, you know, it was just sort of gluten issues weren't known at that time. So cut to, you know, many, many years later, as an adult, I was feeling very, very ill. And for years, I'm thinking, I'm just too healthy to be feeling this sick. Went to every ologist out there. And finally, I self-diagnosed, and 3 years ago, I did take myself off of gluten. I did not test positive for celiac, but I thought, let me give it a shot. And I have to tell you, I'm sort of like a new person today. You know, it's just so great that I feel so much healthier. Problem being, though, that there really aren't – I worked in San Francisco for 5 years, and I did find that getting – sort of gluten-free lunches, anything that was gluten-free minus a salad and yogurt was very, very difficult. So I actually took matters into my own hand and just recently started a grab-and-go gluten-free sandwich business, and we just launched a few weeks ago, and so far so good, so we're really excited, and we had a great response of people who are like, wow, thank you that you're finally out there.
And maybe you can order some of Sadie Sheffer's bread, and you two can become that much more successful in
and
your enterprises.
Yeah, keep the community going. Of
Laura,
course,
thanks.
Feel good.
Thanks for the call.
You're
Joe writes in, I'm wondering if there are any feelings towards all the gluten-free food substitutes that use a variety of different flours and additives. They seem a bit over-processed. Would you say that these are fine to eat, or should we steer more towards whole food options? Melinda Dennis, take that if you would.
Sure. I completely agree with the whole food option. it doesn't, you know, everything in moderation, of course, but you have to remember, if you're trying to make up for lost nutrients, you want to find your B vitamins. Where are you going to find B vitamins? B12 is in animal foods, but the other Bs can be found in the grains such as quinoa and millet and amaranth, teff, sorghum, and buckwheat. Those super six grains that are extremely high in nutrition, we don't see as often as we see the processed and refined rice flour, corn flour, tapioca flour, potato starch, etc. So I would just say, everybody, you know, keep an eye out to try and get as few processed foods as possible in your diet to maximize your nutrition. And we could talk at length about the other topics you'd want to hit, nutrition, including your calcium and vitamin D levels, getting enough fiber.
And let's go next, though, to Sunil, who are rather – sorry, Sunil, we'll get to you, I promise. Let's go next to Julie in Santa Clara. Julie, go ahead.
Hi. I was calling because I was diagnosed with celiac a year ago, and it was a funny situation. My Palo Alto Foundation found it through biopsy, but my blood work was negative. So to confirm it, we did gluten-free for 5 months and rebiopsied, and it actually had healed to a stage one. So they had diagnosed me, confirmed celiac, but I asked for a second opinion. I went to Stanford, and at Stanford, their opinion is that the blood work, false negative blood works, just don't happen, that the tests are so accurate nowadays that they don't see that. So my first question is, how common is false negative blood work? I mean, my biopsy is the gold standard, and that said celiac. And my second question is about cosmetics. I have found.
Can you hang on, Julie? I'm sorry. I just want to make sure we get an answer to your first question. We've got lots of calls that I want to try to get through. But you've raised a really interesting question about diagnosis. Do you pay attention, Dr. Fernandez-Becker, to the biopsy, which showed the damage and then showed improvement when she went gluten-free versus the blood test?
So none of these tests are perfect. And yes, we do see false positives and we see false negatives. And the biopsy is the gold standard. However, it really needs to be evaluated by an experienced pathologist that knows what they're looking for. Because sometimes what is called celiac disease is nonspecific changes that could occur in other diseases. And it's really a combination of having the evidence of the inflammation and the autoimmunity plus the damage to the small intestine or damage elsewhere, like in the case of dermatitis or piriformis, that help clinch the diagnosis of celiac disease. But sometimes it's not clear cut.
Julie, thanks for the call. I'm afraid I'm going to be brutal here and limit to one question per call because we have so many to get through. But thank you so much for adding yours. And we'll go next to Sunil in Los Gatos. Sunil, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. You know, I have a question. Does oats have any gluten in it? I know that was one question I had. And the other suggestion I have...
Hang on, Sunil. I'm going to be rigorous about this. One question. Go ahead. Are oats a problem, Dr. Fernandez-Becker?
Oats are generally not a problem on their own for most people with celiac disease. The problem usually is cross-contamination, because they're processed in places where they process wheat. And in that regard, they could be problematic.
Okay, Sunil, thanks for the call. Sandy is next in San Francisco. Sandy, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Lots of symptoms from celiac or gluten intolerance also mimic mold toxicity. And I found that when I quit gluten, like my rash on my elbows and legs got better, but I wasn't feeling good. And what I found is that they said that genetically, people who can't process gluten also have a hard time processing mold. Hmm. And so I wonder if you've read anything about that. I learned about this through Dr. Shoemaker's Surviving Mold site, and I didn't know if you found that at all. And I guess, again, because some of the symptoms are so similar, that if you've come upon that with any of your patients.
Okay, Sandy, thanks. Dr. Fernandez-Becker.
I have to say I have not come across this before.
Okay, sorry, Sandy, but interesting
Very.
Point. Couple of questions about again, this question of what can be certified, and maybe both Sadie and Melinda, you can respond to this. So someone writes in that the pizza restaurant I worked at had certified gluten-free crust, and it was one of our most popular items. Are there certifications, Melinda, that people can look for?
There are three certification companies in the United States and one in Canada, one by the National Foundation for Celiac Awareness, one by the Gluten Intolerance Group, in Washington State, and one by CSA USA in the Midwest. So all three of those, you can look and read about how they certify individual products. You can also read about restaurant certification programs, particularly if you go on to NFCA or the gluten intolerance group. So entirely different ideas to help safeguard.
And Sadie, how do you go about that with your business? Does your bread come accompanied with a gluten-free certification?
It does not. I actually use a shared kitchen, but I make sure that I'm the only baker in the kitchen. And I'm working with the folks at Zenbelly Catering to try to build a gluten-free kitchen in San Francisco, because none exist right now.
Is that, how much of a concern is that, that your kitchen needs to be? Is this like keeping kosher in a way, that you have to make sure that your kitchen doesn't have anything else in it, Jefferson?
Sure. Obviously, having a totally dedicated baking facility would be ideal. So there is always the possibility of cross-contamination. One thing that a lot of manufacturers actually do is, for quality control purposes, they are cleaning their equipment for every single product run. So sometimes that's more of an issue, depending on, like, maybe in a mill than, say, in processing facilities.
It just occurs to me that when you think about what you were saying before, the number of milligrams that it takes, or when Melinda Dennis was saying that it's, you know, 20 parts per million, this is a very fine art to make sure that this is, because just a little bit can trip you over, Dr. Fernandez-Becker?
Absolutely. And it's not easy to pick up either, because if you ingest gluten, we don't know exactly when the antibodies will become positive. And we don't have any objective measure blood test to see if you've ingested gluten. So it poses a problem.
Here's another important diagnosis question. Diana writes in, I'm so happy you're talking about this. My mother was diagnosed with celiac disease several years ago, and I've struggled most of my life with wheat and dairy, but I don't have the funds to get officially diagnosed. Are there any free clinics that would help in diagnosing?
You know, I think depends on where she is. At Valley Memorial Hospital, there are people there who have interest in celiac disease, and that might be an option.
Melinda Dennis, you're obviously Boston, not here in the Bay Area, but any are you aware of generally whether or not there are options for people who don't have the means to get the diagnosis? Oh, we may have lost Melinda.
I'm trying to think about Boston proper.
No, that's okay. We were just wondering if it's generally a possibility. Do you know anything you can add to this, Jefferson, about diagnosis help if you don't have the means?
Sure. I off the top of my head, I do know that there is a Canadian firm, I do not recall the name, that does like a mail order genetic test. And it's cheap. I think it's like $50 or something like that, I want to say. Don't hold me to that. But well, they'll mail you a test kit. You do a quick swab, and they will then test for the DQ2 and DQ8 markers.
Diana, maybe you want to post something, if you're listening, on this topic on Jefferson's website, celiac.com, and maybe that'll sponsor or prompt some additional responses from other readers of his website who might have some suggestions for you. Let's go to Mark next in San Francisco. Mark, go ahead.
Hi. Wanted to give a comment than a question. About 8 years ago, we went to a lot of doctors and experts for our son, who wasn't sleeping through the night. And finally, an allergist explained or suggested that we go just eliminate gluten from his diet, and he flourished. And about 3 months later, he ate some other kid's goldfish cracker, and suddenly he was like doubled over with pain. And his speech regressed for about a week. So
wow.
Although he had false positive on some of his allergy tests, the evidence of our experience was too powerful for us. And we've been gluten-free for 8 years now, and the whole house is.
Mark, thanks. Thanks for the story. And it shows the degree to which this can have an impact on people's lives. Linda in San Jose. Linda, go ahead.
Yeah, another similar connection between infertility and gluten. I'm curious about your guest's experience with that. In my own experience, it took me 6 years to conceive my first child before I realized I was gluten intolerant. And after I went off gluten, my second child was conceived spontaneously without even trying.
Okay. That's an interesting benefit. Dr. Fernandez-Becker, what do we know about that?
Well, there is a clear association, and we're not sure of the mechanism for this. There are some reports that it might have to do with the autoantibodies that are made in celiac disease. So the bottom line is, like, yes, I agree that there is an association. We just don't know why it happens.
Linda, thanks for bringing that up. And here's another question from someone with another serious condition. Our daughter, age 50, has multiple sclerosis, and it's been suggested to her that a gluten-free diet would be beneficial. So yet another serious health problem. Connection to going gluten-free?
Well, in celiac disease is associated with other autoimmune conditions, and I think there's clear evidence if you have celiac disease for the gluten-free diet. I don't know how strong the evidence for just multiple sclerosis is.
Best advice as we wrap up. We just have a few seconds left. Melinda Dennis.
I would say the best advice is advocating for yourself. Clearly, a lot of people don't like to draw attention to themselves when they're eating out, but this is the way that we're going to make all the progress. So tell people that you have celiac disease. It's a medical diagnosis. And work your best to balance your diet and use the resources from the reputable sites.
And Sadie Scheffer, you want to chime in with a word of advice for your customers?
Yeah, stop eating all the overly processed, commercially available breads and baked goods, and look for anything that has the long fermentation, which will help make nutrients more bioavailable.
And Jefferson Adams, you can find out more about what he is writing about at celiac.com. And also we can offer advice and connections to all of these things. All of these resources and recipes are on our website, kqed.org/forum, if you want to learn more about gluten-free diets. Thanks to all our guests for participating in our program. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.